petition number 23218, Rule 10.
Colonel Goodman Seth, Rule 10. You were saying that there was a lot of stealing from your supply facilities in southern Gaza, and that the Swedes couldn't stop it.
They didn't see anything, but still it continues on to disappearing of supplies. Then the Indonesian took over. They came up later on and took over the guard. And then suddenly there was no stealing whatsoever. Everything stopped suddenly. And the staff was very he thought that was a very good thing, and give them a good note for good work, good guard. And then after a while, complaints came in from the people living in that area. Their dogs, or wild dogs, out in the thing, have been digging up poor corpse all over the place. And the commander of the Indonesian battalion, his name was Sukarno. So this came up, and Sukarno was a good friend of Nasser. So this came up, and it was a big sort of came out of a legal group from United Nations in New York came up to take this into consideration. And then Nasser came on the field. He had got words from his friend in Indonesia, also called Sukarno, that they had nothing to do. They had couldn't have any way do anything against his brother or son or whatever what it was. So they removed the Egyptian, the Indonesian battalion into a sitting place by the Suez Canal in Egypt, and then the Finns took over, and then it was all right.
What had the Indonesians been doing?
They shot everyone they saw.
They shot everyone they saw?
Didn't ask them a question. Hmm. They saw anyone nearing this area, they shot them. Hmm. And they dug them into the sand. And that wasn't much job either, but they were on patrol, so put them down.
What did the Finns do? Did the Finns manage to keep the stealing under control?
Yeah, the Finns also good. And of course, there had been the word had gone in the area. It's very difficult to get near that area. So
the Indonesians had really done a good job for you.
Of course, yes. Yes. I quite agree with them. Yeah. I was called in on every such thing, though.
What about contacts with the local population in Gaza? Did you have to liaise with them?
No. What happened in Gaza when we came down there? The first day we had taken over, the first night it was curfew. But the first day they started big demonstrations from one of the big refugee camps in Gaza town. I would say there was about 40,000-50,000 marching through the streets and making all sorts of noises. The next day, the group was over 100,000. And so General Burns told McKinnon and me that we should find out who is organizing this. And you know who it was? Nasser. Palestinian leader now.
Yasser Arafat. So he was organizing the demonstrations in Gaza.
He and another from his staff. So we arrested him and put him into the prison in Gaza town. And the day after, Egyptian governor of Gaza was appointed, that was Brigadier Helmi. The first thing he did was to let Nasser go loose.
With Arafat?
Arafat,
what was Arafat like, and how did you find him?
I saw him moving in front of his demonstration.
So he was leading it on the ground.
He and his other friend also today is a known person of his staff.
What did Arafat say when you arrested him?
He interrogated him, and he gave away everything you could think of. I'm quite sure that if his grandmother had, or he had no wife that time, or his mother has taken part in this, he would have given him away also. So that he can become a leader of this Palestinians, I don't know. No. At that time, I'm definitely sure that he was a drug addict.
What gave you that impression?
Oh, of course. I mean, talking to him, you know, I mean, he was sickling down on both sides like that.
But he was dribbling.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. He was sitting and shivering and so on because he was in lack of something from it to stir him up, I think. That is my own personal thought, but I'm not quite sure that's right.
What happened then after he was let out by Brigadier Helmy?
He started his organization, but he started that at that time in Egypt.
So he didn't stay in Gaza?
No. He didn't stay there. No. Or if he came back later on in Gaza, I don't know. But, you know, of course I left Gaza in June 57.
So you weren't in the theatre for very long then? It was about...
Three quarters of a year.
Yes, about nine months.
Normally postings for Norwegians were 6 months.
Mm.
So I was three quarters of a year.
Where were you living while you were with the UNF in Sinai?
First of all, of course, to build up and start, we lived in Abu Suair, and we were living in a camp. And then we moved to Gaza, first to El Arish, first to Sinai Desert, where we lived in a small place called El Arish, and lived in small houses on the coast. Mm. But in Gaza town, we requisitioned buildings from the civilians. So, and we organized the school as mess then from the staff and so on. So that went all right.
Was your staff an international body? Did you have officers from all the contingents?
Yeah, and the main staff was, yeah, I don't know many, but it was Norwegian, Swedes, Canadian, one Pakistani. I say there were six or seven nations in the permanent staff.
Whose staff procedures did you use to conduct your business?
Canadian.
Mm. What was that like? Was it similar to the British style of staff work or Norwegian?
Exactly the British system.
It's a British system. Yeah. Did they had
in the staff college at Canada, quite a lot of the books was direct from England.
Mm.
Staff college there.
Did the officers from the other contingents find it difficult or easy to adapt to this British way of conducting staff work?
Some, yes. Mm. Especially the Swedes.
The Swedes? Why? What had they been doing?
They had been doing nothing. They had learned nothing from the war. They had not been in the war.
Mm. And they hadn't studied the war?
No, never. No, the Swedes didn't understand anything.
Mm. Now, you mentioned that the Indonesians were extremely ruthless in the way they protected the stores.
Yeah.
And every nation obviously has its own character.
Yeah.
How did the other contingents perform, and did they have any peculiar ways of doing things?
No, the only other way we had trouble was with the Colombians.
What went wrong with them?
They were raping the young girls in Gaza, and that was a bad thing in that area.
Mm.
Families, you know, this family revenge and things like that.
Well, it would certainly be a very provocative thing to do,
yeah.
Yes. So what form did the trouble take then when they were doing that?
Colombia had to withdraw their battalion.
Oh, they did?
Yeah.
How long were they in the theatre before they had to move it out?
I would say about half a year or something like that.
Yeah. I mean, were there any revenge attacks on Colombian soldiers as a result of the...
No, but we had to keep watch all the time.
Mm.
So, yes. So when I got home from Gaza, I went back as G2 in Army Command. And only half a year after, I was appointed Chief of Staff Trondheim, or Trøndelag. That is the area of the 3rd Regiment, that's a Steinkjer, Trondheim and Molde.
Mm.
all that area that are, and that is normal. That organization we have had, and we still have it with the district command chief. That's the general in leading, and his staff is then complete with G1, 2, 3, and 4, and all the other supporting troops. We had their offices and thing and intranet. And that is a nice and easy job as far as work is concerned.
Why is that?
Because you know you. You make your district command orders, which is only sort of kept alive by small changes, with, if there are any, and that has to be the basis for the regiment to do their planning and so on. And then you inspect your all your equipment, which is distributed all over the area. It's half of, it's not half of Norway, but it's a great big chunk of Norway, from this three fylker. So and that was a nice and easy job. And I was appointed in May 48. And then in August 61, then I was appointed defense attaché. For Germany and Switzerland.
What was the regiment and the district doing in the Trøndelag area when you were the chief of staff? What was
the
their main activity?
They are responsible to set up the units, the mobilization units for each year. And they are responsible to keep those, giving different appointments, trained for the job with courses and so on during this year period. When orders come and they're going to take part in exercises or other thing, they have done everything that's clear on before them, the companies, the platoons, and the different soldiers coming into these different areas.
So this is routine, administrative, and training
and
work.
They have two types of unit. That is the field units, which is in companies and battalions. But they have also the local defense units, which are spread out over the area, companies. So then companies who is self-contained, which has responsibility for a special area.
Well, this be a local defense role.
Yeah. And they have their equipment in that area, in on farms and God knows.
So they could turn out very quickly.
They could be set up in 12 hours.
What about the Home Guard?
Home Guard is, they have been sort of a unit on the side, but as it is now, you know that the Home Guard, one of the main job they have is to secure the mobilization and secure also important buildings and important crossroads or electricity works and
vital points, we would call
vital
it.
Vital points. Yeah.
Well, they would do. Obviously, they would guard the mobilisation. But if the mobilisation was completed within 24 hours or so, what would the Home Guard do after that?
They would take over the guards and all the vital areas.
Yeah. What about the Home Guard up in the north when you
exactly
were there earlier
same.
On? Same kind of thing.
But I think they got a little more exercises than. Because every time there is an exercise in the area, the Home Guard is activated.
They turn out.
They're turning out to take part. So of course they are most part in more than those on the south or the inland who never get any special sort of exercises.
So it sounds like they'd be very well trained indeed for their particular role.
Yes, they are. Yeah. And they, of course, know the terrain better than anyone else.
Would they have been the basis for your guerrilla activity in the Russian rear if the Russians...
Of course they would have,
yeah.
But you know that at that time also, after all that has been discussed, and also we had quite a lot of critics for it, we organized in early 50s, beginning of 50, the so-called stay-behind organization. They built small huts up in the mountains with solid basements, concrete covered on all sides. Their equipment of different kinds for a complete different areas were stored. So that is the experience we have from the last war, where we had to build up this behind organizations which was operating in the mountains. Now we would have it on beforehand, and especially what you have, of course, is the signal system, also the organization of communications, which is permanently in these areas.
So they could be coordinated then, they wouldn't, yes.
We still have those, they are still there. Then.
Who was going to actually man these stay-behind parties?
They're all personally picked out by the staff, by the intelligence staff.
And they would be local people?
Yeah.
It sounds as though you were mobilising all the human resources that you had available.
Yeah, we could do it if it would be needed. Mm. If we were occupied, we would take the same thing as we did last war. So, but you know that it's much more difficult. We have to be in the know, because we didn't have helicopters before.
Yes, of course.
Think of that now.
Indeed. Well, helicopters do make a big difference to mountain operations.
Yeah, of course they do, yes. Mm.
And when you were appointed defence attaché, was that something that you had expected? Was it a...
Yeah, I wanted to. I had no mention of it. And that is, of course, a good position. I was stationed in Bonn, and I was also in Bern in Switzerland. But I can tell you a very nice story when I got down there. Nice and nice. Different from what you say the Russians look out. When I reported... as a military attaché in Bern to Switzerland, the doyen for military attachés was the Russian attaché. That time, General. So I phoned him and said that I will have to report to you according to the regulations. You are the doyen. Denisenko was his name. Denisenko. And then he said, Gudmundsson, I think we should meet at that cafe and restaurant, so we can have a good, nice talk. And when I met him alone, he was also alone, he said, hello, Gudmundsson, do you remember me? I never met the Russians, as far as I can remember. And, yes, sir. I met you as a student in geology, sir.
But he had been in Rovaniemi.
He was in the Russian staff in Rovaniemi, intelligence officer. He knew exactly when I came. He knew exactly, not exactly, but he knew more or less what sort of movements we did. And he thought that we were two nice chaps in the hotel. There wasn't so many to talk. He became second in command in the Russian GPU.
Yeah. What sort of man was he, do you think?
A very nice man. Mm. I very, very sort of spent hours if I get Christmas cards from him this year too. Mm. I had Christmas cards from him for years and years. Mm. But you know that I was defense attaché, so I had both Army, Navy, and Air Force. Mm. So that is quite a thing to cover, actually. The worst thing, of course, is in Switzerland all exercises are Saturday and Sunday. Mm. So that.
You get no weekends.
No.
How did you get on with the Swiss?
The one good thing for me was that the liaison officer for all the attachés in Switzerland was the former Swiss attaché in Oslo. Ah. So that helped me quite a lot.
You knew him already?
I knew him already, yes. So there was nothing much to do in Switzerland, actually. Mm. There was this spy case where the Russian attaché in Switzerland had seduced the wife of the defense chief, but you know, that was so he was expelled from Switzerland and sent home.
I mean, were you invited to go on those Swiss exercises and observe them?
I took part in three or four or something like that.
What did you think of the level of training of the Swiss troops when you saw them?
I would say they compared to our conscripts, you know, in Norway. They were. So of course they had all their equipment at home. If they was going to go outside the country for any time, they could deliver their equipment to the regiment, but then they had to pay for it. And another good thing in Switzerland is the Swiss, you know, as far as I can think of, is that they are absolutely sure that, you know, they have this redou in the central part of Switzerland, which is a mountain.
The mountain redoubt.
And they are 100% sure that their defences kept them out of the war. That is, of course, not the truth. It was the need to have a country, a neutral country in between, that was made so. And you know, in Switzerland, if you go for a higher position in the civilian life, you have no chance to reach top without being an officer. So, but they kept out of two last big ones, of course, and got rich on that.
What about in Germany? What were your main tasks there?
In Germany, it was quite a job because, you know, at that time we bought lots of military equipment in Germany. We had this deal that we took over the production of AG-3 rifle. We bought Leopard tanks. We bought 30 submarines. And Air Force was not much. So we had a sort of a deal within Germany, which we called the 5-3 deal. For each three krone we bought in Switzerland, in Germany, Germany had to buy for 5 krone in Norway. And that deal didn't quite go well, because the plan was, of course, that Norway industry, sort of slumbering industry coming up, was should use this to
reinvigorate itself.
And it was so difficult in the end of that to fulfill they had to export liver paste, jeep wheel jeep deck. What do you call it now? On the, you know, which we have winter deck, winter with spikes on the car.
Oh.
Rifles, yeah.
Tires, of course.
We exported tires from winter tires from Viking here in Norway, which was later. It's gone now for a long time ago. And so such a different thing, but it was, of course, a very good thing for getting the industry in this country going for quite a lot of things, especially Kongsberg. And of course, we had lots of ammunition delivery. That was very force.
I was wondering why you decided to buy German equipment when there had been quite a strong British influence on the Norwegian forces during the war, and you seem to be using British staff procedures and tactics and so on, and so why German equipment rather than British?
Yeah, that was all through the NATO. We were also buying quite a tremendous lot of British equipment. Oh. Is it finished now?
No.
So that was, I would say that the German and British equipment, it was a short time we had quite a lot of German deliveries. But as far as tanks is concerned, we had a competition with using all the tanks in Norway on Gardermoen, by the Norwegian Air Force, with the Leopard, the British new tanks, and the Swedish S-Wagen.
Mm.
And the Leopard was completely sovereign, better than all the others, especially in the winter time.
What was it about the Leopard that made it so much better than the other two contenders?
It was faster. Its firing its possibilities under movement was far higher than the others. The Swedish couldn't fire under movement at all.
The British tank, then, would that be the Chieftain?
Yeah.
Mm. So that was coming in to replace Centurion, wasn't it, that time?
And then, of course, the Chieftain was heavier than the Leopard.
It was quite a very heavy tank, indeed.
Quite a lot heavier than that was the reason for that.
How long were you a defence attaché? What
4 years.
4 years. So that's a much longer appointment than usual, isn't it?
Yes. And then when I was finished as defence attaché, I joined Kongsberg Air Force as a civilian.
Ah. Why did you decide to leave the army?
First of all, then I got the son who had to go to hospital, and he was going to stay there for 4 or 5 years.
Oh.
And then I knew that when I got home in the normal system, I would be sent to North Norway as chief of brigade North Norway. So I wanted to be in the area, and then I stayed at Raufoss and was then the sales director for Central Europe for Raufoss and Kongsberg. So for another five, from 1965 till 1974, I was in the Kongsberg Air Force concern.
Did you find it difficult to adjust to being a civilian again after having been in uniform for so long?
No, I don't think so, because you know, being a defence attaché, that is a sort of in between one civilian life and the normal military life. So I had 4 years then to move into this position I was going to have as a civilian, and more or less to become a civilian again.
Did your work as defence attaché take you into contact with defence manufacturers direct?
Yes.
It did, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. What did the firm you were working for manufacture?
Kongsberg?
Yes.
It's the biggest defence factory in Norway. For all time it's been manufacturing guns and rifles.
Ah.
Our normal Norwegian rifle, the Krag, Jørgensen, and all that. The production of that one started in 1890. And they've been still producing it for some of the local shooting organizations and so on. They're producing guns, and now, of course, Kongsberg is a big concern in quite a lot of different areas. They are in electronic areas, and they're making the Penguin is constructed by Kongsberg, of course, and they've been delivering the Sidewinder to the combined air forces in NATO, and there's lots of things.
It sounds like a firm like Thompson, the French Thompson, which has got
still a lot
expanded into many fields.
Yes.
Yeah. And presumably, then you had plenty of useful contacts when you went to work at Raufoss, and you could.
Yeah, of course. Yes. The main reason was that I was going to follow up the 5-3. Agreement.
Mm. I mean, did Kongsberg manage to sell anything to the Germans?
Yes, Kongsberg delivered. What did they deliver to Germany? First of all, they bought rifles from Kongsberg for a while.
What sort of rifle?
The one we are producing on the German lines. Kogan. They know the. The rifle the Norwegian Army has now.
Oh. That's a self-loading rifle, isn't it? Yeah. Semi-automatic?
Yeah, that is produced on license from Germany.
Mm.